Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo.
Tonight we have an interview in about 15 minutes with George. He's our...
George Dixon.
He's our person that we talk with regularly on Friday nights, but he was on live on our FM show in out of Lakeville, Connecticut on Q103. Last night, and we usually play our interview on Blog Tech Radio, so you get a chance to hear him tonight. We talked a little bit about fractal consciousness and about ascension, in preparation for our internet show on Friday, which will be unity consciousness.
Yeah, I got an article. We read this on last night's show, but this is very important. And I wanted to make sure we had a couple of archives for this thing.
This is about PETA.
Did a good job reading it.
PETA killed 95% of adoptable pets in its care during 2008.
That's
is from
PETA.
I'm going to read it, Leo. Yeah. It's from consumerfreedom.com. Today, the Nonprofit Center for Consumer Freedom published documents online showing that the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, commonly known as PETA, killed 95% of the adoptable pets in its care during 2008. Despite years of public outrage over its euthanasia program, the animal rights group kills an average of 5.8 pets every day at its Norfolk, Virginia headquarters. According to public records from the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, PETA killed 2,124 pets last year and placed only 7 in adoptive homes. Since 1998, a total of 21,339 dogs and cats have died at the hands of PETA workers. Despite having a $32 million budget, PETA does not operate an adoption shelter. PETA employees make no discernible effort to find homes for thousands of pets they kill every year. Last year, the Center for Consumer Freedom petitioned Virginia State Veterinarian to reclassify PETA as a slaughterhouse. CCF Research Director David Mart Osoko said, PETA hasn't slowed down its hypocritical killing machine one bit, but it keeps browbeating the rest of society with phony animal rights messages. What about the rights of the thousands of dogs and cats and puppies and kittens that die in PETA headquarters buildings? Mart Osoko added, since killing pets is an A-OK with PETA, why should anyone listen to their mad demands about eating meat, using lab rats for medical research, or taking children to the circus? The Center for Consumer Freedom obtained PETA's animal record filing since 1998 from the Virginia Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. Members of the public can see these documents at petakillsanimals.com. In addition to exposing PETA's hypocritical record of killing defenseless animals, the Center for Consumer Freedom has publicized the animal rights group's ties to violent activities and shed light on its aggressive message marketing to children. The Center for Consumer Freedom is a nonprofit coalition sponsored by restaurants, food companies, and consumers, working together to promote personal responsibility and protect consumer choices. That was a shock to me. I didn't realize they were such a dreadful organization.
Yeah.
I knew they were bad, but I didn't know they were that bad.
And,
so don't give a cent to them and petition to have them closed down.
Absolutely. And PETA, I forgot what... What is the first word? Ethical treatment of animals, but what's the...
People. People for the ethical...
People for the ethical treatment of animals.
It's people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Right. So, whatever. It doesn't sound like they're very humanitarian to me either.
No, can you imagine since 1998 they killed 21,000 animals or something like that?
Yeah. Here's a good one that came
out. Over 21,000, actually.
Yeah. Do you want to read this one?
Sure.
Scared Cheney puts his head in the noose. Former vice president fears he's held to account on torture and is lashing out And I just read today that a Spanish high court just
is indicting
these guys. Cheney's one of them. Bush, Cheney, and
Rumsfeld.
Oh, Rumsfeld, Fife, you, the lawyer.
Oh.
Yeah, who said that torture was okay?
Good.
And there's one.
How about that slimy guy from Texas?
Grove. I don't know.
No, no. The Attorney General.
Oh, Gonzalez. He was the other one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's six guys. Those are the six people.
He deserved it.
Oh man, can you imagine that? That's wonderful.
He was Bush's boy.
Yeah, but Mr. Cheney here is a little frightened. As is, and this is from the Times Online.
That's why I did the in yellow where the rest of it is just it gets all repetitive. So.
Oh, does it really? Okay.
You want to start here.
Well, you want to read it?
Okay.
Okay,
because
you know, but I think that should do.
Yeah.
Read
the whole thing. Cheney's critique of Obama's policies was inaccurate. Remember, he went on TV and he spoke about and criticized his policies. He claimed the new administration had abandoned the concept of war on terror and returned to a pre-11 law enforcement paradigm. But the noticeable thing about the new administration has been its retention of certain aspects of the terror war that are clearly about war and not law enforcement. It has not abandoned rendition. So what was Cheney thinking? My guess is that he fears he's in trouble. The fear has been created by Obama, but indirectly. Obama has declined to launch a prosecution of Cheney for war crimes, as many in his party and outside would like. He has set up a review of detention, rendition, and interrogation policies. He has simply declassified many of the infamous torture memos kept under wraps by Bush. He has the power to do this, and much of the time it is in response to outside requests. But as the memos have emerged and the awful truth of what Cheney actually authorized becomes harder and harder to deny, and Cheney is desperately trying to maintain a grip on the narrative before it grips him by the throat. The threat, however subtle, is real. Eric Holder, the new Attorney General, while eschewing a formal investigation, has told Republicans prosecutorial and investigative judgments must defend on the facts, and no one is above the law. The Justice Department is also sitting on an internal report into the caliber of the various torture memos drafted by Bush appointees in the Office of Legal Counsel. The report has apparently already found the memos beneath minimal legal credibility, which implies they were ordered up to make the law fit the already made decision to torture various terror suspects. But the big impending release may well be three memos from May 2005, detailing specific torture techniques authorized by Bush and Cheney for use against terror suspects. Newsweek described the yet-to-be-released memos this way. One senior Obama official said the memos were ugly and could embarrass the CIA. Other officials predicted they would fuel demands for a truth commission on torture. Excuse me. The narrative that has taken shape since Cheney left office and lost the chance to stonewall inquiries is damning to the former vice president. It was not an accident, it seems to me, that Cheney went on CNN the morning the New York Times published leaked testimony from the International Committee of the Red Cross. The documents detailed horrifying CIA practice that the Red Cross unequivocally called torture. Shoving prisoners in tiny airtight coffins, waterboarding, beating, sleep deprivation, stress positions, all the techniques we have now come to know almost by heart. And torture is a war crime. War crimes have no statute of limitations and are among the most serious crimes of which one can be accused. That is why Cheney is desperate to avoid. That is what Cheney is desperate to avoid. It is unclear whether he will actually ever be prosecuted, but the facts of his record will wend their way inexorably into the sunlight. That means he could become a pariah. Even though the CIA actively destroyed the videotapes of torture sessions, It could not destroy the legal and administrative record now available to the new administration. So Cheney is reduced to asserting that what he did saved countless lives and averted many plots. He is reduced to asserting the same view of the world that gave us Guantanamo, Van Graham, and the Iraq War. Fighting terrorism is a tough, mean, dirty, nasty business, he told Politico, an American political website. These are evil people, and we're not going to win this war by turning the other cheek. But no one is urging that we turn the other cheek. They are simply saying the West has to obey the laws of war, and the rule of law in its battle against jihadist terrorism. By coming out so forcefully and publicly so soon after he left office, Cheney is intent on asserting that the torture program he set up was legal, moral, and defensible. Like many of Obama's former foes, he may come to regret making that move in his own defense. Mm-hmm. I think he's in trouble.
I think they're going to be hanging on the line there.
Mm-hmm.
In a few seconds. I'm just rewinding my tape here, but there was one other that I wanted to take a look at. That one about the right here, that one right there.
The panel advises depression screening for teens. This is from the Las Vegas Sun. An influential government-appointed medical panel is urging doctors to routinely screen all American teens for depression, a bold step that acknowledges that nearly 2 million teens are affected by this debilitating condition. Most are undiagnosed and untreated, said the panel. The task force recommendations appeared in April's issue of the Journal of Pediatrics, and they go further than the American Academy a pediatrician's own guidance for teen depression screening. An estimated 6% of U.S. teenagers are clinically depressed. Evidence shows that detailed but simple questionnaires can accurately diagnose depression in primary care settings such as pediatrician's office. The task force said that when followed by treatment, including psychotherapy, screening can help improve symptoms and help kids cope. Because depression can lead to persistent sadness, social isolation, school problems, and even suicide, screening to treat it early is crucial, the panel said. The task force is an independent panel of experts convened by the federal government to establish guidelines for treatment and primary care. Its new guidance goes beyond the Pediatric Academy, which advises pediatricians to ask teen patients questions about depression. Other doctors' groups advise screening only high-risk youngsters. Because depression is so common, you will miss a lot if you only screen high-risk groups. The group recommends screening tests, even for kids without symptoms. It cites two questionnaires that focus on depression, tip-offs such as mood, anxiety, appetite, and substance abuse. The panel does not want its advice to lead to drug treatment alone, particularly antidepressants, which have been linked with an increase of suicidal thoughts. Routine depression testing should only occur if psychotherapy is readily available, the panel said. The recommendations come at a pivotal time for treatment of depression and other mental health problems in children. Recently passed federal mental health equity legislation mandates equal coverage for mental and physical ailments in insurance plans offering both. The law is expected to prompt many more adults and children to seek mental health care. Yet at the same time, psychiatrists specializing in treating children and teens are scarce. A separate report also released Monday in the Pediatrics Journal says primary care doctors, including pediatricians and family physicians, will need to get more involved in mental health care. Because children's families often get to know their pediatricians, having those doctors offer mental health screening can help make it less stigmatizing. Most pediatricians aren't trained to do psychotherapy, but they can prescribe depression medication and monitor patients they refer to others for therapy. Dr. Ted Epperle, president of the American Family Academy of Family Physicians, said his group strongly supports that pediatric report. While primary care doctors have full plates just dealing with physical ailments, many recognize the importance of providing mental health services, and many already do. It isn't as always as time-consuming as it might seem. Some screening questionnaires can be filled up by the patient in the waiting room, and doctors can easily spot the red flags. So how are we doing, Leo, with our interview? Ready to go?
Excuse me. Yeah. I have allergies and a cold, and those together make me have cough.
Uh-huh.
I apologize for that. Yes.
So you're all set?
Yeah,
I think so. Put that on.
All right. Well, not really. I'm not quite set yet. Because I don't know if that fully recorded.
What are you talking about?
I don't know if George is. We're on live, by the way.
Well, are you ready to put on the interview?
I don't know.
So do you think you'll be ready in a few minutes to have that?
I might. If you could read one more article for these people, I will.
So what other articles?
I will carry the rest there. Oh.
Leo's having a hard time. He's not finished in a timely manner here.
U.S. sergeant jailed for murdering prisoners in Iraq. I thought that was important.
Takes a few minutes to sometimes cue up this take, so maybe you can get it going faster. U.S. sergeant jailed for murdering prisoners in Iraq. A U.S. sergeant on Monday became the second non-commissioned officer to be convicted of murder for the summary executions of four bound and blindfolded prisoners in Iraq in 2007. Sergeant First Class Joseph P. Mayo was sentenced by court-martial in southern Germany to life in prison. But because he pleaded guilty, will serve no more than 35 years in prison and will be eligible for parole in 10 years. Mayo told the court-martial that he and two other sergeants shot the prisoners in the back of the head with 9mm pistols and dumped their bodies in a Baghdad canal. I thought it was in the best interest of my soldiers, Mayo 27 told the court in the town of Vilsack after pleading guilty to murder and conspiracy to commit murder. Mayo was able to escape a life sentence after a pretrial agreement with the commander of his unit, an Army spokesman said. I really believed I was protecting my soldiers, Mayo repeated in a closing statement that brought him and family members, including his mother, wife, and 10-year-old daughter, to tears. I take full responsibility for my actions, he said. Now I have to pay for my mistake. Mayo said the men of apparent Middle East descent, according to the charge sheet, had been arrested after repeated attacks on the unit, including a sniper attack that killed a friend and a fellow sergeant. The defendant himself had been almost killed by an explosive device a few minutes earlier and suffered diagnosed mild traumatic brain injury, his lawyer, Michael Waddington, said. While making their arrest, the U.S. troops found two sniper rifles, AK-47 assault rifles, and a buff duffel bag full of ammunition. But there was insufficient evidence to hold the men, Waddington told the court, and Mayo said, I believe they would be released. Mayo is one of seven soldiers implicated in the case and one of three non-commissioned officers to be tried for the murder. First Sergeant John E. Halley, the most senior soldier present, is to stand trial charged with murder in Germany on April 13th, an Army statement said last week. A spokesman said Monday that Mayo would testify in that trial. In February, co-defendant Sergeant Michael P. Leahy, an Army medic, was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Two other soldiers have pleaded guilty to lesser charges and been sentenced to prison terms of less than a year, an Army spokeswoman said. Charges were dismissed against two others, including Staff Sergeant Jesse Cunningham, who first revealed the incident to defense lawyers in January of 2008. Waddington told reporters after Mayo's trials had adjourned, "Our objective is to get him out of prison as quickly as possible." All the soldiers were with the 1st Battalion, 18th Infantry Regiment, then part of the 2nd Brigade of the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq, and now in the 172nd Infantry Brigade based in Germany. A character witness in the first trial, 1st Lieutenant Benjamin Boyd, said the troops had been at a combat outpost dubbed Angry Dragon in the southwest of Baghdad that was on a significant fault line between Sunni and Shia areas of the city. I hold fewer people in higher regard, Boyd said of the defendant. I couldn't have asked for a better platoon sergeant. Another witness, Captain David Nielsen Fisher, said the unit suffered from frustration and fear because of the high frequency of attacks on Mayo's small, highly exposed post in West Rashid, one of the most dangerous Baghdad neighborhoods at the time. The U.S. troops are not adequately trained, and angry that the prisoners were often released after 2 or 3 days in custody, only to carry out further attacks and armed with fresh intelligence on U.S. operating methods. But the Army's counsel, Captain John Ressenberg, said Mayo had demonstrated a total lack of moral courage in shooting prisoners execution style. He had urged the court-martial, Colonel Jeffrey Nantz, to deliver the sentence that would send a message to the Army and to the world. There's a little more to this, folks, just a second. Under pressure from the U.S. government, they agreed to accept... Oh, that doesn't make sense. This is the wrong thing. But anyway, I guess that's what happened in that case. He received that time, and hopefully he'll be able to get out with his good behavior. Those war conditions, I don't know even how to comment on it. I've never been a soldier. I've never lived closely with anyone who was a soldier. My uncle was in the British Merchant Service during the Second World War. He wasn't in a fighting position at all. Merchant Service just took cargo back and forth. I mean, certainly they were working under dangerous conditions, but and I really don't know too many people who've been to Iraq or Afghanistan. I can't imagine what it would be like. So it's really hard to comment what happened to those people, whether they totally lost their minds and did the absolute wrong thing, thinking it was the right thing. But when you're in a war situation, terrible things happen, that's for sure. And that kind of war is a difficult one to fight. Sometimes you didn't even know where your enemy was coming from. How are we doing now, Leo?
We're almost there.
So why don't you get that ready for the phone?
I'm going to, unfortunately, I couldn't cue it all the way up, so I'm going to have a read an article that's on there.
Okay.
But, yes, and Lila will be leaving us.
I'm going to say goodnight to the folks while Leo puts that on. It's about 8:24.
Yeah, and I'll be back right afterwards.
Okay.
Okay, thank you so much, Lila.
Well, Leo was trying to take care of his technical
stuff here. So, thanks. And I want to thank everybody for bearing with us here, and I would like to play this... myself reading, it's a reading of another article, and then it goes into the George, our interview for this evening. And I'm hoping that that is okay on the tape. So here we go.
From the Gazette, it's from I believe it's the Arab Press. It's kind of like like Al Jazeera and whatnot. But this, listen to the way that he writes this, because this is a guy from another country writing about this country.
Oh, okay.
And trying to explain what's happening over here. Economic crisis fueling civil unrest in the United States. Five people have been shot dead in California in what appears to be another sign of a social crisis on the back of a falling U.S. economy. Two others, a child and an adult suffering from bad wounds, was transferred to a nearby clinic Sunday night. According to the police, the shooting spree is thought to be part of a murder-suicide, with the gunman believed to be among the dead, CNN reported. The Santa Clara home shooting in California came at a time when U.S. society is already marred by an emerging social unrest, mainly because of the credit crunch. Earlier on the day, another shooting incident killed eight people at a nursing center in North Carolina. If people can't go down to the bank to withdraw their savings or get cash from an ATM, there may be serious civil unrest, said Amy Goodman last October, citing an Army Times piece. But signs of an unfolding social unrest began to appear in July last year when Carlene Valderrama, a 53-year-old wife and mother of from Taunton, Mass., Massachusetts, shot herself after hearing that her foreclosed home was scheduled to be sold at auction. The incident was followed by an attempted suicide by a 90-year-old Ohio woman in October 2008, and an inherent economic-driven social unrest is gradually spilling over other sections of the U.S. society. On March 10th this year, a gunman killed 10 people and himself in an hour-long rampage in Alabama and left his mother, grandmother, and other relatives dead. In another incident in the current month, on March 15th, ensuing a vicious shooting case that happened in Miami, the gunman shot four people to death and committed suicide. The United States top the world with 250 million firearms owned privately. Loose gun control has made the country a hotbed for gun-related crimes. Now, this is coming from the Press TV, which is, I believe, I don't know if it's Iranian or not. It goes, you can get it presstv.ir/detail, and it'll come up. I just got an economic crisis fueling so on. It's just interesting to see how bizarre we look to the Iranians, and I believe that's where Press TV comes from, is the Iranian country of Iran. So anyway, yeah, we're telling them there that they're warlike, we're killing each other over here. But pretty sad. Anything else you want to know? Anything you got there?
Well, this is pretty scary, and this is from the American Civil Liberties Union.
Oh, yeah. Please read that on there.
And this is the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. The American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan asked for an emergency hearing today on behalf of an Escanaba woman sentenced to 30 days in jail because she is too poor to reimburse the court for her son's stay in a juvenile detention facility. Like many people in these desperate economic times, Ms. Nolan was laid off from work, lost her home, and is destitute, said Michael J. Steinberg of the ACLU Michigan Legal Director. Jailing her because of her poverty is not only unconstitutional, it's unconscionable and a shameful waste of resources. It is not a crime to be poor in this country, and the government must stop resurrecting debtors' prisons from the dustbin of history. In December 2008, Ms. Nolan's 16-year-old son was sentenced to the Bay Pines Center, and Ms. Nolan was ordered to pay $104 per month for his lodging. At the time of this order, Ms. Nolan was homeless and working part-time with a friend after being laid off from her job. She told the court that she was unable to pay the ordered amount. However, the judge found her in contempt for failing to pay. In addition, Ms. Nolan's requests for court-appointed attorney were denied. Since March 3, 2009, Ms. Nolan has been serving her sentence at the Delta County Jail. On March 6, 2009, she was released for one day to work. Once released, she picked up her $178.53 check from work, thinking that she could now pay the $104 to get out of jail. However, upon her return to jail that evening, the sheriff forced her to sign over her check to the jail to cover $120 for room and board. She was also charged $22 for a drug test and the booking fee. According to the ACLU's motion, this country did away with debtor's prison more than a century ago. The imprisonment of Ms. Nowlin, because she is too destitute to make payments to the court, is a miscarriage of justice. In representing Ms. Nowlin, the ACLU of Michigan argues that the court unconstitutionally sentenced her to debtor's prison without assessing her ability to pay the court. Additionally, the court violated her rights by denying her request for a court-appointed lawyer. Recently, the ACLU of Michigan represented David Sutton of Detroit, whose probation was extended because he could not afford his supervision fees. Mr. Sutton has no assets, and his only income is his $262 monthly disability check he receives from the government. In 2003, Sutton was sentenced to probation for a year following a conviction in the Wayne County Circuit Court. He performed community service and fulfilled all the conditions of his probation except one. He was not able to pay the supervision fee. Consequently, a Wayne County Circuit judge extended his probation year after year. In February, the ACLU successfully represented him at a hearing where the state had moved to revoke his probation once again.
Okay, I think we have an issue here. Not sure what happened. I was afraid of that. It looks like some of our show didn't quite get recorded, so we have a problem here. Anyway, I'm going to try to attempt to doesn't seem to be anything there. Okay. Anyway, let's see. I could probably do a soft shoe about right now. Trying to think of. I've got a bunch of articles here, but that might work. Here's something. Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Help stop pro-nuke budget amendments now. This was issued March 31st, which was yesterday. And it says, they're at it again, and we have to act again now. The U.S. Senate is currently debating President Obama's FY 2010 budget on the Senate floor. A small group of senators, led by Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham, is preparing to introduce a number of pro-nuclear amendments intended to support still more subsidies to the nuclear industry. Other senators involved are Crapo, Brownback, Vojinovich, and Vitter. And one amendment we've seen would allow money to be shifted around in the budget if the nuclear industry can get $50 billion in new loan guarantees later. Another would allow money to be shifted around if pro-nuclear boosters are successful in getting more research and development money for Generation 4 reactors. Another would do the same if constructed of a reprocessing facility were authorized. These amendments are intended to make it easier for nuclear backers to try again to boost nuclear spending once the budget bill is enacted. It says, please call your senators now and urge them to vote against any and all amendments to the budget bill that would pave the way for additional nuclear subsidies. Capital switchboard is 202-224-3121. And it says, please send your senators an email on these amendments by clicking here. Of course, that is, let me see where it is. At NIRS.org or You can email at nirsnet@nirs.org. Okay? So I hope you get that. Anybody's interested. We've been long-time anti-nuclear activists in the state. We did a documentary on this very thing on Millstone back in 2001, and a five-part documentary. And we spent a lot of time on this and that issue, and recorded about it, and we try to report about it all the time. But one of our greatest fears, or mine and Lila's, was the possibility of nuclear power being being brought back as a viable energy. It's not. There's made no safeguards on this stuff. It's still as bad as it ever was. And what's happening is these old generators are now getting old. All right, and now they're on their last permits, and they can't be operating any longer, so they have to start building new ones, or the power industry will be out of business. So, or at least that part of it will be. But I think it's time. I've often believed it's time now for a brand new technology, and they have this fission. There's fusion and fission, and I'm not sure which one is the. I believe it's nuclear fission. Is the one that creates no waste. There are things out there right now that are already invented that can create energy out of sheer sunlight, just in small crystals. I mean, crystals that can store all kinds of energy. We have the technology. We're just not using it because. These old cumbersome, lazy bastards electric companies. I mean, they're still running wires across your house, rather than put them underground or, create fiber optics of some sort that would work better. I mean, every damned time it rains or has an ice storm or something, you lose power. And, a hurricane or all kinds of things. I mean, if these things were underground, they would be fine, and they wouldn't be marking up the highways and streets and so on. So anyway, this is part of what we're against. And again, please go to nirs.org and get all that information there and sign a petition to stop the Nuclear Power Resource Service. Stop the nuclear power. Sure, I got a couple more minutes, quite a little time left, and nothing to play here. I really don't have anything here. I don't know if I, this came out a little earlier this month. I read it, I don't know if I read it on the show or not. But this particular article says, is the federal government stockpiling survival food? This was back in March, the 10th of March. I think I read this on another program, but that was kind of interesting, and it's something that should be re-mentioned. There's something. Maybe I have time to read both. Wall Street Journal columnist has advised people to start stockpiling food. And an ABC News report says there are worrying signs appearing in the United States where some locals are beginning to hoard supplies. Now there's concern that the U.S. government may be competing with consumers for stocks of storable food. We're told that the feds bought an entire container of canned butter when it hit the California docks. Something up, said officials at Best Prices Storable Foods and I advisory to customers. Something's up, is what they stated. Spokesman Bruce Hopkins told WND he also had trouble obtaining number 10 cans of various products from one of the world's larger suppliers of food stores, Oregon Freeze Dry. And he said the company official told him on the telephone when he discussed the status of his order that it was because the government had purchased massive quantities of products, leaving none for other customers. That, however, was denied by Oregon Freeze Dry. In a website statement, the company confirmed it cannot assure supplying some items to customers. We regret to inform you Oxygen Freeze Dry cannot satisfy all Mountain House number 10 can orders, and we have removed number 10 cans from our website temporarily, and the company tells frustrated customers. The reason for this is sales of 10 cans have continued to increase, and OFD is allocating as much production capacity as possible to this marketing segment, but we must maintain capacity for our other market segments as well. And the company statement continues, we want to clarify inaccurate information we've seen on the internet, blah, 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 blah. But it's just interesting that that this is starting to happen, and so that's the problem. So anyway, I thought you might be interested in that. And there's one other article that got my attention a while back, and I didn't get a chance to read it. But I don't know if you're an Obama liker or Obama hater or whatever you Obama like to do. You know, doesn't make much difference. This article is still interesting. And it's called Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's where it's from. Ludwig von Mises Institute. Advancing the Scholarship of Liberty in the Tradition of the Austrian School. And this is from Mises, Mises.org, obviously from his school. And this came out March 10th. Beating Back Obamanomics. It's raining, pouring economic fallacies by the hour, followed by a flood of horrible policies that is driving us ever further into economic depression. The regime in charge has really gone nuts, revealing itself as both deeply ignorant and horribly evil. We find ourselves facing the horror of what has always been the Achilles heel of the left wing, its abysmal ignorance of economic science. The ideological tendency has gone from the Keynesian to outright socialism in a matter of a few weeks. And the trajectory seems to be accelerated mainly by the logic of the interventionist cycle. Bad policy leads to bad results that are addressed through bad policy and so on, straight down the fast track to serfdom. Obama's attachment to transparency, the buzzword of the day, allows all intelligent people to observe the sickening sight in real time, and to the cheers of the kept class of intellectual phonies like Ben Bernanke and Paul Krugman. The encouraging thing, and perhaps this too was inevitable, is that the right wing is getting its act together. It has suddenly discovered that economics matters. You can cheer on the hot wars, fight the culture wars and crack down on political dissidents all you want. But in the end, what makes for the good society is a sound economy. Without it, all the rest falls apart. Thus, all our favorite conservatives are starting to make sense. The American Spectator is alarmed. Rush Limbaugh sounds like LRC. The American conservative has temporarily dropped his love of protectionism to warn off dollar inflation. The love of war has gone AWOL at National Review. The Heritage Foundation is warning that government spending and taxation are driving us to ruin. Pat Buchanan is defending the free market. Where were these people during the last 8 years of Bush misrule? Asleep or seeking preferment or something? It's not as if Obama caused this crisis. He's only making it worse. In any case, the right has begun to turn to the side of truth and justice precisely as they did during Clinton's rule, and this is all to the good in general. Oh, this guy's coming from it. But just in case, we are observing yet another expedient shift. It might be a good idea to understand precisely why socialism is a bad idea. Yeah, the Obama administration doesn't seem to get it, and there is plenty to get. Socialism crushes human rights, builds the state, impinges on the liberty of conscience, and breeds social, cultural, and economic degeneration. People have made those points for hundreds of years. Somehow, and for whatever reason, many people rejected these critics. No, they said, all of this sounds plausible, but you don't understand how the sheer glory of the socialist ideal, with perfect equality and social justice, will bring about a new sense of things. And mankind will be inspired to share, create, work, and obey by the astonishing emergence of a completely new form of social organization. Ludwig von Mises, in 1920, however, added something special and new to the critique of socialism. He said that socialism, in all its forms, cannot accommodate any economic development beyond the hunter-gatherer stage. And the reason has to do with the socialist attack on the ownership and exchange of capital goods. Without ownership, there is no exchange, and so prices do not emerge. Here is his 1920 essay, which says it all. It goes, without market prices for capital goods, accounting is not possible. You would know if you are making money or losing money, saving resources or wasting them, doing the right thing or not doing the right thing. Think of all the decisions that have to be made on the production end that require you to know whether you are wasting resources or not. With steel, do you make more buildings or trains? Or do you make cutlery or computers or cars or cables? You can't just rely on assessing consumer demand. The demands for stuff is infinite. What matters are choices in light of foregone alternatives. These can't be discerned with polls or intuition. What matters here is the weighting of all alternative uses of resources. We can only be worked out in real time, in light of the choices of consumers and the profitable production decision of producers. None of this is possible if you don't have real market prices providing the real stuff that makes cost accountable, accounting possible. Collectivize property and you abolish the market for capital goods. No price emerge. Every choice you make is arbitrary. There is no more rationality remaining. You just end up groping around in the dark. No socialist has ever been able to provide an answer to Mises' devastating point. And why? Because no socialist has seriously thought through how their cockamamie system would work. Lenin used to say, oh, whatever, just run the whole economy the same way the post office is run. But notice, the post office has a problem with innovation, pricing, cost accounting, and making ends meet. Its only source of life comes from the completion provided by private competitors. Its only source of life comes from the competition provided by private competitors. The post-officization of the entire economy would mean a return to barbarism. Mises' illustration of the failure of socialism provides a fantastic meaning to discover what is right about markets and wrong about all forms of collectivized economic planning. It shows what happens when you nationalize banks and credit, but it also shows what is wrong with all bureaucracies. Mises put all his criticism together in a single book, a book that remains a definitive refutation of the entire intellectual apparatus of socialism. It is a classic, a must-read, a treasure for all ages. To read it is to be amazed. It has changed the minds of millions of people since it appeared in 1922. It is the one book that utterly crushes the economic agenda of the left, revealing what fools they really are. While Mises points out that Mises's point has also been a fruitful one, further theorizing about all forms of collectivism. See, for example, Theory of Socialism and Capitalism by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And look, it's not as if a socialism is a new idea. It was tried in the 20th century. It produced economic stagnation and despair, and in the purest form, it extinguished more than 100 million people. That's why the Black Book of Communism must be owned and read and understood by every thinking person. It is the most terrifying book you will ever read. It is a standing rebuke to any living soul who claims that economic understanding doesn't matter. Take this seriously. This is where the Obama tendency is leading us. And the book is called The Black Book of Communism. And it costs $43. Wow. That'd be a good one for a book. Well, it doesn't look like a very big read either. Socialist Manifesto. So, that's about that. I hope you enjoyed that. I thought that was an interesting article because it was so weird. And it's knocking Obamanomics, which is knockable. But we're on a mission, folks. We're on some kind of a mission. I don't know what it is exactly, but it's where we're headed. We don't seem to have... I mean, we just keep putting one foot in front of the other, you know. Basically, that's all it is. That's all it is. There's so much stuff, you know, about Obama being such a big radical and being such a bad guy and evil, evil, evil. Maybe he is. But you know what? If you go back to my last shows, about 2 weeks ago, I believe, that may have been last Thursday, the show, I did probably the week before. I had it featured anyway on my show page. And it's about the tarot. It's a tarot reading that I did for Obama as well as one I did for the United States. And it doesn't show that tragic ending that everybody's saying is going to happen. And it just doesn't show that Obama's on the wrong foot either. And it doesn't show any demonic manifestations or anything. So I was quite surprised at that tarot reading. And I was very happy, actually, that it was that way. And I wish the guy a lot of luck to get a hard job. And I just hope that... out there leading us somewhere in the right direction. If not, they'll find out real quick. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. I guess I'm going to might cut the show a little bit short. But I want to thank you. And join us tomorrow night. We'll be better prepared. For some reason, the interview that I was going to play tonight with George Dixon... that we did last night we're unable to play. Technical problem with that tape. So I want to thank everybody, and I wish you a good evening.